Coming up on Weekend America.
As the election approaches, the battle cry is sounded.
You guys are our cavalry. You're the last vestige we have to go out there and try and convert these swing states and get them converted.
The war for voters is on. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, the call for campaign finance reform is nothing new. Just ask William Jennings Bryan. Well, you can't because he's dead, but if he were alive, he'd say this.
An election is a public affair. There is no sound reason for secrecy in regard to campaign methods.
We commemorate the 100th anniversary of the soundbite, briefly. And when you're at sea for well over a year, you need music, sea shanties, pirate songs, or...
Dolly Parton would be blasting, you know, working 9 to 5, and we'd be going with the boxes and sampling our dates, going, oh my gosh, we haven't had dates in months, you know.
Welcome aboard Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This hour, we're going to have some adventures together. We'll take to the open water with a guy who's trying to set the world record for most consecutive days at sea. He has been out there since April of 2007. We also travel back in time to the birth of the soundbite. John McCain isn't the only one dragging William Jennings Bryan into this race. We're doing it too. Plus, some top-notch high school debaters give tips to today's presidential candidates. And behind the scenes and way up in the sky at an air show. What trick would you perform in an air show?
I would swoop down as close as I could to the crowd and hit the afterburners and just rock everybody with a sonic boom.
Well, you know what a barrel roll is, right?
You know, a big circle.
It's like rolling down a hill, except for in the air.
Yeah, if I were in an air show, I would definitely do the barrel roll.
It's like an amusement park ride.
I love roller coasters, but realistically, I would probably just do a series of ups and downs and see how many G's I can tolerate.
Not falling out would be the best trick I could possibly have when we were flying upside down. Not throwing up would be probably the second best trick.
It's a good trick. Those voices came from Birmingham, Alabama, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Phoenix, Arizona. 24 days until the election, and all eyes are on the so-called battleground states, which is exciting if you're a Floridian or Virginian or Coloradan, but you might be feeling left out if you're Californian or Alabaman or Idahoan. Idahoite? Fact is, the majority of Americans do not live in swing states. Still, there's probably one fairly close by, no matter where you are. And what neighbor isn't at least somewhat tempted to lean over the fence with a little friendly advice? As Keisha Simister reports, the campaigns are happy to exploit that urge.
The latest polls show McCain 9 points ahead of Obama in Texas, but you wouldn't know it from the number of volunteers at the Obama headquarters in Austin. Last weekend, 50 of them crowded into a warehouse for a special training.
I hope you're all fired up. We're going to get ready to go now. Right.
Bill Loudon is mobilizing the faithful at a meeting called Camp Obama, and when he says ready to go, he means it. These volunteers have pledged to hit the road and knock on doors in a nearby swing state. Across town, McCain supporters are holding a prayer meeting at Rudy's Barbecue in North Austin.
Father, we do want to thank you that you are the one who guides, you are the one who ordained the governments in this world.
About 25 people are gathered around indoor picnic tables, including Brandon Lighton, a 21-year-old with Students for McCain.
The farthest I've ever traveled to block walk before was West Austin.
This time, he's going a bit farther, Michigan.
If you really believe in something and you really believe this is an important election, then it's what you do. You have to figure out where you can really make a difference, and that's probably one of the bigger swing states.
Donald Green is professor of political science at Yale and author of the book Get Out the Vote. He says candidates win or lose elections based on their ground game.
Well, a very well-run and managed campaign that is brought to scale in a swing state can probably mean 2 or 3 percentage points of the vote. And what's interesting about it is that these are often voters who are not going to show up in polls because they aren't likely voters.
In 2004, the polls were favoring Kerry, but the Bush Get Out the Vote effort made the difference. One thing is certain, the Democrats are determined to not let that happen again. The Obama campaign is spending significant amounts on weekend workshops. They're modeled on the senator's own experience as a community organizer. At the recent Camp Obama in Austin, Bill Loudon provides a sort of basic training for volunteers.
You guys are our cavalry. You guys are the warriors that Obama is putting forward to go out in the field. You are that last best vestige. That's the best I can do without the music. You're the last vestige we have to go out there and try and convert these swing states and get them converted.
Obama's staff teach volunteers skills like phone banking, team building, and block walking. The campaign is demanding a serious commitment. The volunteers will go wherever headquarters says they're needed.
Yeah, I'm kind of impulsive.
So he's gung-ho, and I'm gun-shy, so I think between the two of us we'll balance each other out.
Rob and Rebecca Stokes signed up for Camp Obama a day after watching Governor Palin fare better than expected in the debate. They were planning a month-long honeymoon in the Midwest. Now they're devoting a week of their romantic getaway to the campaign.
My wife's pregnant, and I feel like, wow, you know, I'm home in my home state. I want to make a difference. I don't want to just sort of skip across the surface anymore. And so I feel responsible to make some sort of change.
The campaigns are keeping their strategies to themselves. They won't even talk numbers. But Obama seems to be better organized in Austin, and Green says that's true across the country. He says Obama not only has put more money into his ground operation, but he has an ability to recruit volunteers.
Yeah, it's one of the more remarkable things about his campaign, that he can drop into a campaign rally, not only draw a large crowd at a drop of a hat, but also get very large numbers of people to sign up as volunteers.
But it's way too early to write off the McCain campaign. They have a similar swing state operation they call the Deployment Program. But their training is nowhere near as intensive as Camp Obama. They seem more focused on phone banking. But McCain supporters are crossing state lines. Pat Peel, a Republican in Dallas, is heading to Colorado. Peel worked swing states in 2000 and 2004 with the Texas Strike Force for the Bush campaign.
You know, the direction it was under Karl Rove and Ken Mellman last time was much more explicit. President Bush had such an organization, and they were very, very much tuned into what needed to be done, when it needed to be done, and how it needed to be done.
Between the 2000 and 2004 elections, Republicans increased their voter turnout from 107 million to 124 million. But McCain doesn't appear to have inherited that organization. For one thing, Bush's support has plummeted. And for another, the Christian conservatives who made up Bush's base were reluctant supporters of McCain. That changed when he brought Sarah Palin on. But it may be too late. Still, Green says McCain has a smart strategy.
They're working with a much more targeted list. They're trying to focus on those kinds of voters who have a high propensity to vote, but who seem persuadable or at least seem sympathetic potentially to McCain. That in their view, probably gives them the best return for each dollar spent.
And with the election so close in the swing states, anything could happen. It really depends on the decisions made in the next few weeks, which is why each party is keeping their strategy under wraps. Professor Green says it's really a game, with both sides scheming and stealing glances at their rival before making a move.
Well, there's really a chess game going on, and in some ways it's a waiting game. Now that the McCain campaign has pulled out of Michigan, the question is, where will those ground troops be redeployed? There's talk about moving them to Indiana, but presumably Ohio would be a more daring choice. And I think that on the Obama side, the question is, will they be able to detect where the McCain troops are being deployed so that they can counter strategically?
There's a reason they call them battleground states. And if you're in one of them, keep your eyes peeled for operatives and expect foot soldiers to come knocking on your door. In Austin, Texas, I'm Keisha Simister for Weekend America.
Well, interest in this election is indeed high. 63 million of you watched the last debate. And if you missed that debate, you have only one more chance to see these guys in action. Wednesday night in New York is the final contest between John McCain and Barack Obama. That means this weekend, the Obama and McCain camps are doing some intense strategizing. Now, even though they didn't ask for it, we decided to get some advice for the candidates. So we brought in two of the top high school debaters in our area. Kira Stevenson and Nicole Wagner debate for Egan High School in Egan, Minnesota. Welcome to Weekend America.
Thanks.
Hi, nice to be here.
All right. We're going to dive right in and hear an immediate contrast from how you debate to how they debate. And you're going to be debating in very, very short format. This year's debate topic, the United States federal government should substantially increase alternative energy incentives in the United States. And Nicole, you're going to go first, so whenever you're ready.
Even one meltdown kills hundreds of thousands, coupling in 06. Using the most recent models and making the optimistic assumptions, reactor meltdown would have 518,000 cancer fatalities, would result in more than 45,000 short-term fatalities and the relocation of 11 million people. Next, health damages resulting from nuclear reaction explosions are worse than Nagasaki and Hiroshima, cause cancer and thyroid diseases and affecting tens of millions of people.
Okay. I think we all learned a lot. And Kira, you are prepared for the rebuttal whenever you're ready.
One, no statistical basis for nuclear power being dangerous to other energy is birth of Lewis and 06 fears about nuclear power not found around statistical facts. Nuclear power is one of the safest form of power production. The most dramatic instances involving energy production do not involve nuclear power at all. The number of lives negatively affected by nuclear power is overwhelming to dwarf by accidents in other areas of the energy industry. And nuclear power safe, no accidents. Bellar in 04. We designed and operate nuclear plants with multiple levels of containment and safety and multiple backup systems. Nuclear power is the most safest major source of energy.
Stop. Thank you. Why do you talk like that?
Well, really, the point is to get as many arguments in as possible, and since we only do have 8 minutes, we want to speak quickly so we can put out as many different arguments.
Normally, you have 8 minutes. We know that a high school debate and a presidential debate are two different things. Many people say that a presidential debate isn't even really a debate. Do you think they should be training for speed a little bit more and trying to get more of these points in like you guys do?
Well, I really don't think that speed is appropriate for the arena that they're speaking in because, you know, they want to be clearly conveying their point. And lots of times, the faster you speak, the more muddled what you're saying can be. But I do think that they need to be more efficient in what they're saying instead of being so roundabout in their answers.
Did you watch the debates?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. What were you thinking when you were watching them?
I was wishing, first of all, that they would answer the question, but I also think it would be really nice if they got to do cross-examination like we do in our debate, because I think that it would really be helpful to the voters to really have the candidates examining each other's position so we can really clarify what they're talking about.
There was much made in the first presidential debate over John McCain not looking directly at Barack Obama. Was that good technique or bad technique?
You can glance over at them occasionally, but really you're trying to convince the American people on your issues and how what you think of them. So you should look at the audience because that's who you're persuading.
How do you psych out your opponents?
Well, we do have a lot of evidence that we bring into rounds, so you can kind of intimidate your opponents if you bring in four huge tubs of evidence and the other person looks a lot less prepared if they only have one. But I mean, I really think the best psych out is just purely knowing what you're talking about and being confident in that. I mean, if someone stands up and they have clear evidence based on, you know, what they're saying and they can give empirical examples, they're going to sound, you know, like they're saying the right thing compared to someone else who doesn't really know what they're talking about.
Kira Stevenson and Nicole Wagner from the Egan High School debate team, thank you. And the presidential candidates, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Egan High School is competing in a tournament at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis this weekend. Let me do that again just so the debaters can understand me. Egan High School is competing in a tournament at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis this weekend.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
It's the 100th anniversary of the soundbite. Listen to one of the first ones. I would say more, but it seems inappropriate to elaborate. Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. If you listen to a public radio newscast or watch a TV news program this weekend, you're likely to catch some sort of coverage of a speech by Barack Obama or John McCain. But they won't play the whole speech, obviously, just a snippet, a cut, a sound bite. We think of the soundbite as a product of the modern information age, but it turns out the soundbite is celebrating its 100th anniversary. Producer Ocean Kalin takes us back to the presidential election of 1908.
The campaigns come down to two final candidates, Democrat William Jennings Bryan and Republican William H. Taft. Now, before the 1900s, it was considered unseemly for a presidential candidate to campaign for themselves, so others would do it for them. Party officials or running mates, even actors traveled around the country performing a candidate's speeches. But in 1896, William Jennings Bryan changed the game when he hopped on a railway car and gave his own speeches, reportedly to millions of people, something unheard of at the time. Well, he lost that election, but 12 years later, when Bryan ran for a third time, there was this new kooky thing popping up in people's houses, a phonograph.
Oh, where my love lies dreaming.
It actually wasn't new. Phonographs had been around for about 30 years, but they were only now cheap enough and actually safe enough so that regular people could own one. The Edison Company approached Bryan and asked to record some of his campaign speeches. But there was a problem. Wax cylinders could only hold a few minutes of sound. Political speeches were rambling lectures that could go on for hours. But Bryan was a gifted orator and didn't see a problem. He'd just distill a single idea down to 2 minutes. One cylinder, one idea. Just the highlights.
An election is a public affair. There is no sound reason for secrecy in regard to campaign methods. And publicity will in itself prove a purifying influence in politics.
William Jennings Bryan on campaign finance. But the press hammered Bryan as a blowhard who just loved the sound of his own voice. His campaign was humiliated until the public got a hold of the recordings and they flipped for them. Taft somewhat begrudgingly agreed to record a few cylinders of his own. Here he tells the government to get out of the way of business.
The combination of capital in large plants and manufactured goods to the greatest economy is just as necessary as the assembling of the parts of the machine to the economical and more rapid manufacture of what in old times was made by hand. The government should not interfere with one any more than the other, for they are then the natural results of modern enterprise and are beneficial to the public.
People around the country held listening parties where they'd play cylinders from each candidate. A few entrepreneurs set up mannequins of the candidates and alternated cylinders in sort of a surreal mock debate. But more importantly, everyday citizens brought the ideas of the candidates into their own homes. People wanted an eloquent summation of the stance they support on the issues they care about, banking regulations or civil rights or national security. The soundbite was born, and the audience loved it. William Jennings Bryan lost that election too, but President Taft's recordings came back to haunt him when he was up for re-election. Turns out it's a little too hard to ignore broken campaign promises when everyone has a recording of you making them. I'm Ocean Kalin for Weekend America.
We have full recordings of those sound bites on our website in case a sound bite of a sound bite was unsatisfying to you in some way. Check it out at weekendamerica.org. Okay, we know that on the weekend, some of you like to hit the town, perhaps consume one or more than one adult beverages, and then you get home where your computer is, and that's when the dangerous temptation emerges. To email your ex or maybe the object of your crush, it's a terrible idea. You will regret it. But in the moment, you can't stop yourself, idiot. This week, Google announced a plan to save you from yourself. It's called Gmail Goggles. Did you hear about this? You program it ahead of time, and if you attempt to send email within certain hours, it will fling a quick math test up on your screen to see how clear-headed you are. If you don't pass, no email. We sent producer Sasha Aslanian out to some college bars to see whether math could really stop drunk emailing.
Plum's Neighborhood Bar in St. Paul is a gathering spot for students at several local private colleges. Here, I find some authorities on drunken emailing.
There's misspellings. There's lots of confessions of love.
Lots of swear words.
And there's someone, like, you wouldn't even expect, like, one of your, like, really weird friends. Like, not even, like, a good friend, but, like, an acquaintance. Yeah.
And these four women haven't just been on the receiving end of drunk emails. At our corner table late at night, it's true confession time.
I've sent assignments, though, when I was drunk for an online class.
I have, too.
I would have rather not done that.
Across the bar, I put the same question to one of the guys.
Have you ever sent a drunken email that you regret?
An email? I don't send emails. I've written on Facebook that I regret it, but no one writes emails. I'm 22, so it's like, I'll write emails if I'm looking for a job or something, but as far as emails go, not really.
Emails passe. Facebook and text messaging are all that count. Outside the bar, a chatty group of patrons immediately sees ways to extend Google's idea.
Cell phones. Because by the time that I get to a computer, I've already done something stupid. But if my cell phone recognized my voice and, like, realized it was slurring and then they, you know, it stopped me with a voice message, it would be almost like a conscience speaking to me.
Technology serving as a conscience. Wow. I drive to nearby McAllister College, where the men's hockey club is meeting, and apparently sober.
None of you guys are going to sign up for this?
I already did, actually. I signed up for it, like 2 days ago.
This is a tougher crowd for Google. The guys didn't like the idea of a filter.
They should learn from a mistake than rather having a computer program monitor your drunkenness.
In my unscientific poll, women seemed more appreciative of Google's attempt to prevent stupidity. Men seemed a little more resigned to let the chips fall where they may.
I have doomed myself with a cell phone.
But also, I've had
fun drunk conversations. That's
the whole judgment thing, that I have totally doomed myself with a cell phone. I've also forgotten about a long-lost friend and been at a party or left a party at 2 in the morning and had the best conversation of my life.
And isn't that the hope of everyone with beer goggles on? In St. Paul, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Weekend America.
Oh, I am so thankful that I was safely married before I even got my first email address, and long before Facebook.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
New York is a long way from Senegal, but for one Senegalese entertainer, a trip to the Big Apple was a matter of life or death. Ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Week in America. I'm John Moe. It wasn't that long ago that politicians on the stump had to talk about all sorts of issues. They had to read the voters and figure out what was most important to each voter. For some voters, the war was the big thing. For others, the environment or health care, maybe education, maybe foreign policy. Well, today it's simple. It's the economy. What are you going to do about it, politicians? But simple doesn't necessarily mean easy. For a few weeks now, we've been bringing you essays from folks around the country about what they think should be on voters' minds this election. We're calling it Conversations with America. This week's installment comes from writer Heather Ryan of Eugene, Oregon. She's had the economy on her mind for a long, long time.
As the summer wound down, I found myself in a terrible spot. I was out of money. I teach freshman composition at a university and write on the side. I'm also a single mom to three kids who are 10, 8, and 6. Work had started, but my first paycheck was a few weeks out. We needed staples, bread, milk, eggs. I wondered what I could sell. I didn't have jewelry, family heirlooms, or swanky gadgets. I came up with two ideas: sell my books or sell my plasma. I had hundreds of books. I even had books written about other books. I figured that if I sold 30 of my favorite books, I might pocket $75. I also had lots of good, healthy plasma that had never been exposed to IV drugs or mad cow. The local plasma center pays $35 for the first donation and $45 for the second. You can donate twice a week. It took about 3 seconds to choose selling my plasma. I could regenerate my plasma while I slept. Replacing my books would require money. But I also didn't want to sell my books because of what they represented. I use my books to teach, and I reread passages when I'm stuck in my own writing. Sometimes, when it's been a particularly rough month, I walk through my rental house at night. Even though I wear used clothes, I have my stacks of books. They remind me of classes I took, papers I wrote, praise I garnered. These books are integral to my life because they are a symbol of what I still long to believe in. The idea that with hard work and intelligence, I will someday have an easier life. Poverty doesn't look like this, I tell myself. You're not poor. America faces an economic disaster that could rival the Great Depression. Political candidates are talking about the crisis as though it's new. But for many Americans, poverty is something we've been sliding quietly into for years. So many of us now qualify as poor, despite education and hard work. We didn't expect our lives to look like this. I teach at a major university, work full-time, and only make $27,000 a year. And I'm one of the lucky ones. This election, I wonder who will represent people like me best. Monday, I drove my old car across town to the plasma center. People packed the lobby and were quietly ushered back by technicians. When it was my turn, a woman pricked my finger, then dismissed me for low hematocrit. They didn't want me. To leave, I had to pass through the donor floor. People lay on beds with IV snaking from their arms. The blood was drawn and the plasma extracted. The blood was then pumped back into each person's veins. People shivered because their blood had cooled. I walked through the room, tried not to look at anyone. I wanted to turn around, ask for another chance. Later that afternoon, I parted with my old copy of The Great Gatsby and 20 other books. This election, I'll remember that feeling at the plasma center. I'll remember that poverty isn't about selling books or plasma. It's about running out of options. It's staring into a parking lot hemmed with chain-link fence and wondering what you can part with next.
Heather Ryan teaches at the University of Oregon. She also writes a blog called Terrible Mother. You can find a link to that at our website and join a conversation. That's all at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Today is National Coming Out Day. This week also marked the 10th anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death. You remember the Wyoming college student who was killed because he was gay. Now, Senegal is a long way from Wyoming, but some sentiments are global. Pop Mbaye is a well-known Senegalese entertainer who is also openly gay. In February, a magazine published photos of him attending an underground gay wedding. He was threatened and attacked. He fled to Gambia but had to return home after the Gambian president announced that he wanted to behead all gays. Pop is now a refugee in the United States. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper caught up with him in New York and with his lawyer, Christopher Nugent, in Washington, who is also his interpreter.
Chris, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you very much.
And Pop, we'd like to welcome you as well.
Thank you very much.
Pop, I want to start with you. What happened in May that made you finally leave Senegal?
Oui, en mois de mai, il y avait les journaux qui ont écrit que Pop Mbaye est de retour au Sénégal.
In the month of May, the newspapers reported that Pop Mbaye had returned to Senegal. And the population was following this news, and then they came to my house and to confront my mother.
Ma famille et ma mère ont dit que je ne suis pas là.
My mom and my family told them that I wasn't there, but the people, they broke into the house. They entered the house by force, and then they started beating my family. And I realized then that I didn't have any further security to stay in Senegal because they were after me.
Chris, how prevalent is Pop's experience in West Africa?
We have many, many clients from West Africa who are subject to systemic persecution by government authorities and civilians that the government's unable or unwilling to control.
Yeah. He's a big problem in Senegal. Every day, me and my friend have much problem.
Pop, what can you do now as an openly gay man in New York that you couldn't do in Senegal?
Je peux porter tout ce que je veux porter.
I can wear whatever I want to wear.
Et je peux bouger, faire ce que je veux faire dans ma vie.
I can move around however I want to move around.
Sans persécution.
Without persecution.
Oui, sans personne qui peut me gêner à vivre ma vie.
Without having anyone prevent me from living my life.
Now, you helped Pop get refugee status here in the United States based on his persecution relating to his sexual orientation. How prevalent is that?
Oh, it's a rarity. Pop is one of the luckiest gay people in the world. Pop benefited from the fact that Human Rights Watch in Dakar contacted us immediately, and we were able to evacuate him to Accra, Ghana. He was attacked in Accra by Senegalese because he was so well known and vilified in the Senegalese media that the United States government took extraordinary steps to expedite his resettlement to the United States within a month. It was the fastest resettlement case I've ever seen.
Wow. You were recently in New York with Pop, and what was that like for you two to be together in the States?
Well, it's always an incredible experience because I work with clients overseas. So then we finally meet. We have this incredible bond. So in New York, we ended up going to a club and met people from the music industry, and then I dropped him off at a gay nightclub where he it was way past my bedtime. I went back to the hotel, but he stayed on.
Had he been to a gay nightclub before? Are there any in Senegal?
No.
That's not accepted at all.
So what was it like to be in the club?
I felt so good. I felt so honored. I found my life in New York.
That's great. Thank you, Pop, and good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chris.
It's my pleasure. C'est mon plaisir.
In San Francisco this weekend, families are crowding the downtown waterfront to watch planes swoop through the air during the annual Fleet Week air show. Every year, more than 20 million people attend air shows across the country, but not every family is watching from the ground. Jason Parr went for a ride with a young pilot who's part of a unique family business.
On a sunny morning in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, 27-year-old Eric Tucker is preparing me to fly in his bright red two-seat aerobatic airplane. He's an airshow pilot, and his plane is designed to flip and roll at over 100 miles an hour. If anything goes wrong, a floating seat cushion isn't going to cut it.
Okay, so now that you have your parachute on, I'll give you the parachute brief. So basically, a lot of people get nervous about wearing a parachute. I get nervous about not wearing a parachute.
That's partly because a parachute saved his dad's life. He's also an airshow pilot. The engines start and I'm pushed back into my seat as we accelerate down the runway and climb into Eric's workplace. Soon, we're carving through the sky, changing direction in the blink of an eye.
So what we'll do is we'll start rolling here, and we'll start tumbling the airplane.
Eric sounds like he's sitting on the couch at home. I feel like I'm going through a washing machine. The airplane rolls and somersaults end over end at the same time. I see a rapid mixture of earth and sky and hope Eric is keeping track of which way is up. In fact, Eric has been working air shows since he was 9. He started by announcing for his father's performances. Back then, Dad hoped Eric might choose a different way to make a living.
Because the business is so hard, I didn't really want Eric to get into the air show business.
That's Sean Tucker, Eric's dad. It's not just that it's a dangerous business, but it also means that Sean feels a father's responsibility for his son's safety and livelihood. But when you're up in the plane with Eric, it's clear there's no place he'd rather be.
And then we'll recover. Out and dive. How about we'll just throw in a big old victory roll after that?
Eric sends the plane twirling like a corkscrew through the air and gives the maneuver a kind of sublime grace. Then he looks back at the smoke trail we've left behind, sounding like a kid doing this for the first time.
Man, look how that smoke is just hanging. I want to dive down and just do that one thing that we did where we trace the smoke around again.
I brace myself to go through the victory roll all over again. From the ground, maneuvers look impressive. From the inside, they can feel downright violent. And I'm not even getting the worst of it. If Eric did his most difficult moves, I would likely pass out or get injured. The G-forces are that intense, especially when you're pulled out of the seat.
So what we're going to do is we're going to roll upside down. There's one negative G, one times the force of gravity. Now relax. We'll do a half outside loop. So just relax. Breathe deeply. Tell yourself it hurts so good.
Hurts so good, it feels like my eyes are going to pop out, and my whole head is throbbing. Sean and Eric are used to it. They perform together as part of a formation team with two other pilots. At times, they're flying only a few feet apart, doing loops and rolls. That's a whole new kind of father-son bonding.
Like any father-son, we have our times where we just butt heads, probably because we're just too similar in many ways, right? And then also, but we have the side in the formation team where it's completely level playing fields.
When Eric and I are in the sky together flying, he's not my son, he's my peer. And I have to make sure that I remember that at all times because, I mean, I'm counting on him not to hit me and he's counting on me to perform at a level where I don't take us into the ground.
It's a stressful job, but that's not the way Eric sees it. When he's in the air, he feels liberated, like he's tracing a sculpture in the sky.
It's just like this three-dimensional palette. What we say is we live our entire human lives on the XY axis, just on a two-dimensional plane of the Earth. What we get to do in an airplane is take it into the Z axis, where the freedom is just unparalleled.
With that, he pulls straight back on the stick, and we start climbing up for one last dance through the air. Flying, tumbling, and rolling in the skies over Oshkosh, Wisconsin, I'm Jason Parr for Weekend America.
We have video of Sean and Eric rolling and looping through the sky. I'm watching it now, and it's probably better for your stomach to watch it on the computer than actually go up in one of those planes. Check it out if you dare. It's at weekendamerica.org. Now, Halloween is just 20 days away, and if you don't have a costume, you had better get started. In my house, my daughter is even now stewing over which Powerpuff Girl to be. I'm hoping it's Buttercup. But let's be real here. It's not about the costumes. It's about the loot, the prize, the candy. And we've been wondering around here, what happens to all that candy after Halloween, after it's sorted? There's a whole taxonomy of candy sorting, of course. Snickers at the top, then your lesser candy bars, and so on down to the stuff from the houses that give out the raisins and the carrot sticks. You know, those houses that always seem to get egged for some reason. But the candy after Halloween is hoarded, it's stashed, it's rationed, sometimes it's pilfered by mom and dad. It has this whole post-Halloween life. And we want to hear your post-Halloween candy stories. What did you do with all your treats as a kid or as an adult? And how are you attempting to regulate your kids' sugar intake? Drop us a line, weekendamerica.org. Okay, I'm about to blow your mind. In parts of Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana today, there will be snow. Snow, snow. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to finally put my flip-flops away for the year. For a look at weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Sugar beets are ugly, knobby root vegetables, but Chinook, Montana gives them the Rex Harrison My Fair Lady treatment during its Sugar Beet Festival. 47 and sunny for best dressed sugar beet and best carved sugar beet. Also, a beef cook-off? Cattle call and branding contest? Huh, maybe Sugar Beets Montana for cow. Sure, you can eat corn, but why be predictable? Oakley, Kansas is making corn a competitive event at its annual corn husking contest. Test your husking skills solo or on a team, then win big money. Okay, win small to medium money in the corn throwing contest and the corn money pile. Corn money pile. 80 and sunny, so blow that prize money on a hat and some sunscreen or diamond-encrusted corn on the cob holder pokey thingies. The art of cultivating miniature trees or bonsai is more than 2,000 years old, and one place is renowned for its bonsai culture, North Carolina. Tiny little trees get center stage at the North Carolina Bonsai Expo in Asheville. Cloudy and 68 for bonsai trimming workshops, flower arranging demos, and three stages of death metal bands. Okay, that last one's a lie. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
If you're trying to sail for 1,000 days straight, you're going to need some music. Besides that Christopher Cross song, I mean. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. On April 23rd, 2007, Reed Stowe and Sonia Ahmad left New York Harbor. Their goal? To sail for 1,000 days without touching land. Reed and Sonia set out to beat the world record for endurance sailing, sailing without resupply, and that currently stands at 658 days. Today is day 538, and in this installment of our Listening In series, Gideon D'Arcangelo talks with Reed and Sonia to find out how music helps on the open seas.
Where are you, Reed?
I'm in the South Pacific, 1,000 miles south of the Galapagos Islands, right in the middle of the wide open part of the open ocean.
Reed Stowe is standing on the deck of the schooner Anne,
the 70-foot wooden boat he built himself some 31 years ago. He's on his satellite phone, telling me how he survives day to day out on the water.
First thing I do is I check the deck, because I've been getting a lot of flying fish on deck, and they're delicious.
When fish don't jump right on Reed's deck, he catches them the traditional way, with a line. He gets his veggies by sprouting mung beans for salads. But life on a boat isn't always that romantic.
There were times when, say, we ran out of something in the galley. That's the kitchen.
That's Sonia, Reed's girlfriend and partner on the voyage. She's back on land now. We'll get to that in a minute.
Tumble out of bed and stumble to the kitchen. If we ran out of oats and we had to go get more oats, we'd go in the cargo hold. And the cargo hold is all packed, stacked with boxes chest high. So to get anything, you have to move something. We'd start into that stack of, you know, heavy boxes, moving them aside. Dolly Parton would be blasting, you know, working 9 to 5, and we'd be going with the boxes and sampling our dates, going, oh my gosh, we haven't had dates in months, you know.
But life for Sonia on the schooner Anne wasn't all work.
Sometimes after dinner, that was a time when we didn't do any work. And we'd just sit outside on the cockpit table. And sometimes we'd put on some very slow instrumental music. Sailors are not supposed to like being becalmed. But that was among my favorite times, was when the wind stopped. And usually, I would say this happened more in the doldrums around the equator, in the mid-Atlantic. So we'd be becalmed, no wind, the boat would just be there on the ocean, and the sea would be glassy. Then we'd also have a school of mahi-mahi following us, and those are like rainbow fish, very, very beautiful, iridescent colors. And unfortunately, when you catch them and you kill them, their colors fade to gray. So they look like any other fish. But in the water, they're like magic fish.
Calm moments like this were rare, and Sonia found herself becoming overwhelmed with seasickness. After 305 days, the nonstop record for a woman at sea, a boat had to come and pick her up off the coast of Australia. For nearly 8 months now, Reed has been sailing solo.
After 500 days and after some very stormy weather, my sails have gotten quite damaged, and that's a lot of hard work for me, sewing my sails and keeping them together. Usually I put music on when I go into my cargo hold to sew sails.
Mother, Mother Ocean, I have heard you call.
So I've had this listening to Jimmy Buffett thing going. It's music that I can sing along with, and it's music about sailing.
You've seen it all.
Reed is getting ready to round Cape Horn, the tip of South America, which is infamous for its hazardous currents and rough weather. As the months of solo sailing wear on, Reed is reaching for songs that make him feel most connected to his people back home.
It seems like I reverted back to old classic rock and roll. And it just makes me feel good. And the songs remind me of my youth, when it was an innocent time and I was happy and carefree, and like Wooden Ships by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. When I play it now, it reminds me of the innocence of my youth and being at home with my loving parents and family and those things that are so far from me right now.
When Reed finally returns to land, he will be welcomed by a new face at the shore. Remember Sonia's seasickness?
I suspected by the time we got off the boat, by the time we reached Australia, but I did not know for sure. When I got off, I then checked, and yes, I was pregnant.
Reed and Sonia's son, Darshan, was born in July. It was a tough call, but together they decided that Reed will stay the course and try to break the endurance sailing record.
Like Ulysses, it'll be a little while before I get home, but I'll be home to my family, and I'm looking forward to it.
Darshan will be almost 2 years old when Reed sails into New York Harbor in the spring of 2010. After his 1,000 days at sea, the family will be united for the first time, and you can be sure there'll be a happy celebration that day on the schooner Anne.
Wooden ships on the water, very free and easy. Easy, you know the way it's supposed to be.
In New York, I'm Gideon D'Arcangelo for Weekend America.
Talking about very free and easy.
We have photos of Reed, Sonia, and the schooner Anne in some high seas also. That's all at our website, weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the entire program. It's very free and easy, I think I can safely say. That's at weekendamerica.org. You can also find the podcast at iTunes. Whether or not you're going out on a long sailing ship or maybe just for a walk around the neighborhood, get out there and enjoy your weekend. Bye now.
We are leaving. You don't need us.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Mudslinging, special interests, dirty tricks. I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, politics can get rough when you're in high school.
Because we were talking about having a class trip to Hawaii at that point. Yeah, and then we ended up spending $20,000 on the prom, so that went pork, all pork.
A grown man reflects on the lessons learned from a highly negative high school political career. Join us